This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We continue today our coverage of developing events at the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant in Nebraska, just north of the major city of Omaha. During our last report, it was revealed that there had been a level 4 emergency declared at the plant because of the imminence of flooding from the Missouri River. The Army Corps of Engineers advised that the height of the river would be reaching or soon exceeding 1,004 feet above median sea level. And in that interval, the plant was required to go into emergency operations to defend and protect against flooding, of which there have been problems in the past at that plant with leakage passageways at the junctions of walls and of pipes and other related items. During our last report, yet more news came in that during the day, there was a fire, an electrical fire in a basement of that nuclear power plant that caused an evacuation of the plant from approximately 9:30 or 9:40 a.m. local time until after 1 p.m., approximately 1:30 p.m. local time. During that time, part of the plant was rendered inaccessible because of poisonous gases and of gases that were used to extinguish the electrical fire. It gets even worse. We now know that the systems that were incapacitated by that fire at this nuclear power plant called Fort Calhoun in Nebraska, it had been shut down for refueling, but this electrical fire incapacitated parts of the cooling system for the spent fuel pool. Listeners might recall that one of the great hazards at Fukushima is the tremendously overpacked spent fuel pool at Unit Number 4. This is an important story, and we are honored to have with us one of the most prominent experts on these issues, Arne Gunderson, a former nuclear power plant operator and chief advisor for Fair Winds Associates. Arne Gunderson, what is the latest you know about what is going on and what has happened and been minimized in the reportage generally about the situation at Fort Calhoun?
Well, thank you for having me, and your summary was really excellent. The sandbags and nuclear power plants really don't belong in the same sentence, and now we're seeing one that is literally putting sandbags up to reinforce itself against the flood. I think the real issue here is, why are we having this flood? There's a lot of snow in the Rockies this year, more so than a long time, and all of the dams upstream are full. So all of them are just opening up their water and letting it cascade down to the next dam, which is letting it cascade down to the next dam. Well, the plant was designed against a flood that it can't get much worse than this, or else it's going to breach the walls. But my concern is, what if a dam breaks? That would be the equivalent of the Fukushima tsunami. These dams are filled to the brim, and there's more than one. So, you know, it doesn't mean that the one that's immediately upstream has to break. It's any one of a series has to break, which could inundate this like Fukushima was with essentially an inland tsunami. The dams are not, structurally sound, built to the same standards as a nuclear plant. But in fact, the nuclear plant is now relying on the integrity of something that's basically a big earthen berm.
If one of these, almost like an electrical circuit in series, resistors in series, if these dams, which we might liken to resistors, any one of them broke, that would put extra stress on all the ones downstream of it, would it not?
That's correct. So, it will probably ride out the storm if the storm doesn't get any worse. They're within a foot or two of what they were designed for, and hopefully it looks like that the flows that are coming out of the dams, as the Corps of Engineers has opened the valves, they can just barely get by. But if Mother Nature throws us, a knuckleball here, all bets are off.
We have seen reports that the water is already treading on the edges and the walls of this nuclear power plant. There was a television station near the nuclear power site that, despite the admonitions of the nuclear power company, because the Missouri River is a public waterway, went boating up to the edge of the plant and saw it at the jeopardy of the encroaching water. 1,004 feet above sea level going up, and the Weather Service and the Army Corps of Engineers says that it is expected to do nothing but rise until well into the summer of this year, 2011. Generically speaking, Arne Gunderson, nuclear plant operator and advisor on nuclear issues for Fairwinds Associates, what is wrong with water in a nuclear power plant? What are the hazards in the basement?
Well, there's safety-related equipment that when the nuclear chain reaction stops, and this plant is shut down, it was shut down in April for a routine refueling, and then they said, oh, my God, we got this flood coming. We better not start it back up. It was scheduled to be running by now. But even though it's shut down, there still is an enormous amount of heat left over from the particles that are left behind called radioactive daughter products. And we're seeing that at Fukushima. You know, the plant is still steaming because of all of that residual heat called decay heat. You got to get rid of that even after you've shut down the plant. And so there's pumps like the ones that failed last night that are required to run for months, even years, after the plant is shut down to keep the nuclear core cool. And, of course, the concern last night was that two pumps failed in the fire, and not the nuclear core. It remained cooled through a different set of pumps, but the pumps that failed last night didn't cool the fuel pool. So the fuel pool began to get hot. They recovered the pumps, and the fuel pool cooled back down again. But again, you know, we all have Fukushima in our mind, and Unit 4 and Unit 3's fuel pool are sitting there smoldering and right on the edge of boiling. And normally these things should be at roughly 60 or 70 degrees. So they're not designed to boil in a nuclear fuel pool.
In the process of refueling this Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant, does the main assembly, the nuclear pile, does it stay inside the reactor, or is the whole assembly moved to a spent fuel pool? Where is the fuel? I understand that about one-third of it, one-third of the columns of uranium and perhaps other oxides were to have been taken out and replaced. Where is that stuff? Is it in the reactor, or is it in the spent fuel pool? And what would you estimate to be the capacity of radioactive materials in the pool? And as a follow-up to that, Arne Gunderson, does heating attempt the process of zircaloy hydrogenization?
There was one-third of the nuclear core that's been removed and is in the fuel pool, along with many other nuclear cores. There's 20 years or more worth of nuclear cores in the fuel pool. And that's on the pumps that failed last night. So that generates an enormous amount of heat. And the closest example that I could tell you is Fukushima 4, which if you recall the pictures of the steam just pouring out of that fuel pool. Without water, that fuel pool will boil dry in several days. Now, the NRC's position is, well, you don't need to call that an emergency pump because you have several days and you can always spray water in and things like that. The problem with that argument is that as it's boiling or approaching boiling, it releases an enormous amount of humidity, and that wipes out all of the electrical wiring in the containment. So you don't want to get anywhere near boiling, and I don't know that the NRC really understands that issue yet. The other issue of what's in the nuclear reactor, there's fresh fuel plus two-thirds of the nuclear core. Now, the pumps that cool the nuclear reactor, the NRC considers safety-related. The pumps that cool the fuel pool, the NRC says, are not. And those are in a separate cooling system. They did not, they were not involved in the fire last night. But the flood is encroaching on all of that wire. Unlike Fukushima, the diesels are high enough so that as the flood comes up, they'll probably be able to retain diesel power unless there's a bigger wave, you know, from a dam collapse. I think that's the lesson here, is that Mother Nature can throw things at us that we did not anticipate. And, let's hope that that a flood like the one we're seeing is as bad as it's going to get.
This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and that's Arnie Gunderson in Vermont. And, Arnie, one of the beauties of this kind of listener-sponsored broadcasting is that we can look in more depth than the superficial ways in which much nuclear news is being covered, if at all. In the past day and a half or so, most conventional press reports simply said, well, there was no danger of the release of radiation, and did not sufficiently, in our opinion, address the issue of the potential heating up of the spent fuel well, of the loss of monitoring or the loss of cooling systems and such. Because we have this opportunity, I'd like you, as a nuclear expert, to help us walk through the nuclear event reports from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. As of the 7th of June 2011, there was not a report on that day of the electrical fire after the flooding emergency was declared on the 6th of June. However, today we now have some items from the NRC's event reports, which, if anybody needs a frightening bedtime story, just read these each and every day. And, Arnie, I'd like to actually take some time to be very specific with you so you can translate this for our audience, okay?
Okay, go ahead.
All right, this is the nuclear event report for the 8th of June 2011 in regard to the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant. I'm going to read four segments seriatim. Beginning at about 9:30 Central Daylight Time, the licensee noted fire in the west switchgear room. The fire brigade responded and found a room filled with smoke, but no active fire. Halon did discharge in the room. At 09:56 Central Daylight Time, off-site assistance was called, and Blair Fire Department responded to the site. Blair Fire Department confirmed no active fire in the switchgear room. All off-site power remained available, as well as the emergency diesel generators if needed. The licensee is currently attempting to ventilate the room, a thorough inspection of the affected area, and determine the cause of the electrical fault will be facilitated once the room has been fully ventilated. What is a switchgear room, and what level of disorder was taking place at that time?
The switchgear room is like a giant fuse box. If you think of the fuse box in your house or apartment, you know, there's a box on the wall with a lot of wires running in and out. Well, in a nuclear plant, one, there's a lot more wires, and two, that they don't run on 100 volts, they run on thousands of volts. So these wires are really, really thick. They go in and out of the switchgear room, and there's fuses in there as well, and switches. Well, what seems to have happened was that a wire or more than one wire overheated and caught fire. Now, the switchgear room has a halon fire extinguishing system. It doesn't use water because last thing you want to do is put water on wires. So the halon was injected into the room and put the fire out. So the flames were gone by the time the plant got there, but the damage was done. So the fire department, the fire brigade on site, and they have a group of trained people that give up their whatever job they were doing and become firemen. So the firemen report to this area, and the smoke is so thick they can't go in. Seeing smoke, they said, well, let's call for backup, which is they called in the local fire department as well. And so now they've got professional firefighters there plus their own cadre. The smoke is burning rubber, burning plastic, burning fused material, and it's toxic. So, again, they couldn't get into this area. So, you know, it's interesting when they said they couldn't see a flame. Well, given all that smoke, it's hard to imagine you could see a flame, but obviously there had been one because there was smoke. But in any event, they had a fire that produced a lot of smoke. The halon put it out, but they couldn't get into the area because the smoke was toxic. So then they'll bring in air filters and fans and pump that air out. And meanwhile, at least two of the wires that ran into this room were wires that powered their cooling pumps for the fuel pool.
Go ahead. All right. Let us go to the next part, and here we get great specificity about the failing systems that end up with a disabling of the cooling systems. This is from 10 minutes after the first announcement or noticing of the smoke and or the fire. And here we quote from the official Nuclear Regulatory Commission event report at Fort Calhoun. At 9:40 CDT, an alert, HA2EAL1, for operating mode less than 210 degrees Fahrenheit, was declared for a fire affecting the operability of plant safety systems required to establish or maintain safe shutdown. Time of fire was 9:30 CDT. Control room received multiple alarms, and 480-volt bus 1B4A amps were observed to be oscillating. Bus 1B4A was secured, and buses 1B3A and 1B3A to 4A were lost. Halon activated properly. At 09:56 Central Daylight Time, all notifications to appropriate personnel were completed. At 1000 hours CDT, 4160-volt outlets 1A2 and 1A4 were secured to facilitate firefighting. Spent fuel pool cooling was lost as a result of the de-energized buses, and the licensee entered AOP-36 for loss of spent fuel pool cooling. Heat-up rate was determined by STA. Current time to boil for the spent fuel pool is 88.3 hours. Spent fuel pool cooling is currently back in service. This condition is being reported pursuant to 10 CFR, et cetera, for declaration of an emergency class specified in the licensee's approved emergency plan. Do you get a gist of some of those buses and how huge or heavy they are?
Yeah, well, when you hear about 4,000 volts, that's, you know, your house is 100, and that's roughly the size of the power line that runs down the street. You know, it's a big power line because these pumps are huge. So in order to go into the room, they had to, some of the fuses had blown, but they had to deliberately turn off other wires. And in the process, turned off the wires that were powering the fuel pool. And the other part of that was that they were talking about the oscillation. What that means, that doesn't mean that the wire was moving. That meant that the voltage was swinging wildly. So the control room operators are seeing numerous annunciators. That's, you know, like the little dashboard light, you know, engine problem. Well, they probably had 20 or 30 little engine lights saying engine problem popping up all over the plant. Now in the background here is this flood, you know, so these operators are focused on the flood, and all at once they get blindsided by a fire in the switch guard, in the switch gear room. So the other part of that then is that the STA, that's the shift technical advisor, it's an engineer who happened to be there then, figured that they had about 80 hours before they boiled the fuel pool. And, that's probably, you know, that's a a back of the envelope calculation, and but they had a couple days before they boiled the fuel pool dry. Go ahead.
Okay, next item from the event report, and this is as of 1:15 p.m. local time. That would have been 2:30 in the afternoon Eastern Daylight Time. At 13:15 Central Daylight Time, Fort Calhoun Nuclear Station has exited alert HA2EAL. It has been confirmed that no fire remained in the vital area. Plant shutdown cooling remained in service and spent fuel pool cooling was restored and temperature verified to be lowering. The licensee has also exited alert HA3EAL1 after it was confirmed that the environmental conditions from the event and associated halon discharge does not affect the ability to safely operate or safely shut down the reactor due to being in mode 5 and shutdown cooling remaining in service. Fort Calhoun remains in unusual event HU1EAL5 for river level greater than 1,004 feet elevation as reported under a prior advisory.
What they're saying there is mode 5 means that there's no power being generated and the plant is basically stopped. So had this been at a different power level, mode 1, 2, 3, for instance, this might have had a different outcome. They fired back the pumps, and it's interesting because this swimming pool is roughly 50 feet by 50 feet by 50 feet. It's a lot of water, and if you figure out his calculation there, that it was heating up 50 feet by 50 feet by 50 feet of water was heating up at about 2 degrees an hour. That's a pretty quick heat up of a massive amount of water. So then they're not saying that there wasn't damage, but what they're saying is they've got the smoke out. They've got the, they can determine that the damage allows them to turn back on the pumps they turned off, but they're in no situation where they can. They've got a major repair in front of them, which they really don't have a clue how significant it was or what the causative event was. But they can exit the emergency because they've turned those pumps back on, the refueling water pumps, the fuel pool pumps, rather. They can exit the emergency, and essentially the NRC can stand down now. But that doesn't mean that the damage is fixed. As a matter of fact, it doesn't mean that they have figured out why the damage occurred. But they're basically saying that it's not going to get any worse.
One other thing, Arnie Gunderson. There was yet another anomaly. You might call it a human telecommunications malfunction. And some might find this disturbing, that when the plant entered its emergency condition or status, the procedure was to have been to notify all the plant personnel that were essential to operation safety and or maintenance to come quick to the plant. They were supposed to have been paged in order that they might immediately return. Not a one of them were, according to the reports, from the NRC event reports. The employees were not paged. They don't know why that didn't work. What is the significance of not having the staff there during a time of emergency?
Well, this time they got lucky, and there's no significance, but basically they got lucky. You know, when you have a fire of this magnitude, and you know, plants have fires every day, you know, small, that they'd never call in the outside fire department. But when you call the outside fire department in, that's a big deal. And you're supposed to then get other essential people in to back up your staff. In this case, they happen to skate through without needing those extra people. But, you know, what amazes me about that is that they have a procedure up in the control room, and literally there's people up there checking in every minute. You can tell by that log. Every minute they were checking in and making sure they were complying with the procedure. And for some reason, somebody missed that step. Now, because there's a flood, the NRC has put in extra inspectors on site. So there was an NRC inspector in that control room 24 hours a day, and the NRC inspector didn't see it either. So it was, it's significant. You know, they got lucky. They didn't need those people. But it's more of a, you know, thank God, as opposed to that's the way things are supposed to work.
We are in a set of conditions, particularly weather-wise, climate-wise, runoff, spillage, dams, and runaway water systems, where the condition of Fort Calhoun may be emblematic of other nuclear power plants across the country. The water risk exists at those near the coast, like I believe Seabrook is, with possible water levels rising and the ability of unexpectedly high tides or hurricanes or confluences of events to cause the water overflow of a nuclear power plant. We're talking today about a plant on the Missouri River in Nebraska. But just over the past several days, there has been damming and undamming of the Mississippi River in and above Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And there are, as I understand it, two or three nuclear power plants that stand in the water runoff region that could also be affected and put under a condition just like Fort Calhoun. What is your understanding of that, Arne Gunderson?
Yeah, it's, you know, all of these plants have to be on a major piece of water because they need that water to cool them. To my mind, the worst ones in the country are in California. There's a plant near San Diego called San Onofre, and it has a 9-meter-high tsunami wall. The tsunami that hit Japan was 15 meters high. So, you know, their position is, well, our experts have said we'll never see a tsunami as big as 9 meters, when in fact we know that the Pacific can really get angry and throw something at it. A tsunami of that magnitude in California would knock out all the vital systems required to cool the reactor. But probably the other one that was the near miss, if you will, is Turkey Point in Florida. So now we're on the opposite coast. And it wasn't a tsunami, it was a hurricane. Hurricane Andrew pushed a tidal surge inland, one, the winds were astronomical, and two, the tides were so high that we almost lost that plant, Turkey Point. The security system was knocked out for 3 months, and the radiation alarms were knocked out for almost as long. And the infrastructure was knocked out. The plant was down to its diesels, and luckily the diesels ran, and luckily there was the tidal surge was not quite high enough. But, you know, if it happened, it's likely that Mother Nature can throw out something that's another 3 feet higher than that. So I don't think we should be complacent saying, wow, we got through this, see, our design is great. I think the lesson here is that, wow, we got through this by the hair on our chinny chin chin, and we need to really evaluate whether or not we should beef these things up even more.
Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, we have alluded to but not yet directly addressed the ongoing situation with the similar fuel pool risks in Fukushima. And since we last spoken in person, there have been tremendous revelations, many of them vindicating the intuitions and inferences that you made long time ago about the meltdowns, about the containment breaches, about the flooding, about the release of hazardous, highly radioactive material. And the crisis is now so apparent, even as far away as the garbage piles of Tokyo, much less the green tea farms or the rice paddies throughout more than just the Fukushima prefecture in Japan, that this was a tremendously huge breakdown and release of contamination. And it has taken this long for TEPCO and Japanese nuclear so-called regulatory officials to acknowledge this. What is your understanding of the current condition of the various plants, the half dozen of them at Fukushima Daiichi, and now the revelation of thousands of tons of radioactive liquid waste at Daiichi, at the second complex. What's up with Fukushima?
Well, we're not going to get the straight story out of the Japanese government. I think that's clear. We're not going to get the straight story out of Tokyo Electric. Luckily, compared to Chernobyl, we have the internet now, and there's quite a few independent scientists who are getting some very accurate radiation readings and providing a much more accurate radiation profile of what went on in Japan. And you're right, we've got radioactive sewage showing up at hundreds of miles away, and we've got radioactive fish as far south as Hong Kong. We've got the tea leaves. Outside the plant, they found plutonium in the soil right outside the plant gate, about a mile away from the plant. And in the Fukushima prefecture, they found the radiation in the ditches on the side of the road from road runoff is about 200 times normal. So clearly there is an enormous amount of radiation released. Now, a couple scientists are have set up air filters in Tokyo and in Seattle. And what they do is they pull in what your lungs breathe in the course of a day, which is about 10 cubic meters, and through a filter, just like a cigarette filter. And then they open the filter up and they look for hot particles. And in April, the latest data is from April, a person in Tokyo was breathing in 10 hot particles a day from Fukushima. And that's, what a hot particle is a piece of radiation big enough to do cellular damage in your lungs or your GI tract. But the interesting number is, so Tokyo was getting 10 hot particles a day. Everybody in that city was breathing in. Seattle had 5. So here we are, an ocean away, and still we're getting hit by hot particles from Fukushima.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute, Artie. You said 5 particles in Seattle, Washington, in the northwestern part of the United States. Where are these measurements coming from? Because it's my understanding that there has been minimal measurement from EPA and other agencies. Please reiterate that. That sounds important.
The EPA has stopped monitoring, and frankly, they weren't monitoring very well even when they were monitoring. They've gone back to their normal environmental radiation monitoring. The FDA is not monitoring any fish or any any produce that's coming into the country from Japan is not being monitored by the FDA. So again, this is independent scientists who are telling me this is what we're measuring. Now, science takes a couple months before these journals get published. But I can assure you it's good science, and yes, we're seeing for April, Seattle was only half the amount of radiation that Tokyo had. Now this isn't, you can't walk out with a Geiger counter and hold it up in the air and see it go nuts. A hot particle doesn't behave that way. A hot particle is about a micron, which is smaller than the diameter of a hair, gets carried across the Pacific and has a charge to it. So when you breathe it in, it sticks in your lung. Or when you ingest it, it sticks in your GI tract because of the charge. You can actually go on the internet. There's actually a great picture of an ape lung with a hot particle in it. And you can see the damage that the hot particle does over the course of a year. Not every hot particle causes a cancer, but it's a constant irritant in your lung. And eventually, irritation in your lung leads to COPD or cancer. So I think we cannot underestimate that Fukushima is going to cause cancers in the long run in the Northern Hemisphere.
Artie Gunderson, note for our audience that your work is being celebrated and discussed around the world. We are aware that you were recently on CNN, a subject of much discussion, and I'm happy to say that one of our interviews is actually being discussed on a German physics website, a blog of scholars, of German nuclear physicists. And I'd just like you to bring people up to date about your latest activities and how one may keep up with your invaluable work.
Oh, thank you. I don't let it go to your head, but I would have to say that you're one of the smartest interviewers I've ever had. Our website is Fairwinds, Fairwinds, and it's we have, we're doing all this for free, my wife and I, but there's a donate button on the site to help our, you know, we have to pay somebody to keep our website running and things like that, if anybody cares. We try to post a video a couple times a week, and basically I say, well, what do I think is important, and I talk for 5 to 15 minutes on a topic several times a week. Like you said, they have been heard around the world, and I'm especially proud that ours, your my interview is now being played in Germany, because I recall that one, and frankly, it really touched on what was important.
Well, Arne Gundersen, your work is Promethean. It is liberation and revelation and a protection for people who are lied to by authorities who may be in over their head, much like the Fort Calhoun nuclear power plant soon. So it's with great gratitude and tremendous response from our listeners and people of concern everywhere that we're just happy to be part of this work.
Well, thank you for caring. I really appreciate it.
Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates. That's Fairwinds, Fairewinds.com. You're listening to 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network, originating at station WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. More after this.
All day I face the barren waste without the taste of water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water, cool, clear water. The nights are cool and I'm a fool, each star's a pool of water, cool water. And with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water, cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water, cool, clear water. The shadows sway and seem to say, tonight we pray for water. Cool water. And way up there he'll hear our prayer and show us where there's water. Cool, clear water. Keep a moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's the devil, not a man, and he spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? Water, cool, clear water.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, with thanks for production today to engineer Michael G. Haskins and our new intern, Thiago Barroso. And we thank you, the listeners of this radio station and other public stations, for keeping independent voices alive and prominent.